Welcome back to the Miss.
Good start,
from
ladies and gentlemen.
Deep inside your radio.
Yes, a very good start. That's an omen, we call it. That is an omen. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to ignore what happened there and just press on. Because we're going to press on like as if we were Sally Hansen Nails. Ladies and gentlemen, the burying the lead segment of the show comes here at the top, where it belongs, where you wouldn't bury it. This is a story from the New York Times this week, the thrust of which is that we all know, and we're going to talk more about it on today's broadcast, and by we, I mean me, about the National Intelligence Estimate issued by the CIA in October of 2002, which was the basis for your congresspeople voting for the war, and the fact that the executive and congressional summaries of that NIE, as it's called, tended to eliminate some of the caveats. That's a phrase they use. It's a word they use. That were present in the full text. Now, it's before we get to the burying the lead, it's interesting to note that was pointed out by the Senate intelligence report that came out in this country a little while ago. This week, in Britain, the Butler Commission, issued a report on British intelligence. Basically saying Tony Blair operated in good faith. There'll be more about that in a moment. But saying that the British intelligence officials, when they reported their intelligence on Iraq pre-war, tended to leave out some of the caveats in the basic intelligence. Systemic problem in Britain. A week and a half after it was reported that we had a systemic intelligence problem in the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, that could only sprout on Nutty Coincidence Farm. We are being told that two of the finest intelligence agencies on the planet Earth had the same systemic problem at the same time over the same issue. Totally just because, wow, that is nutty. Anyway, back to the buried lead. So there is a one-page summary of this national intelligence estimate that was given by the CIA to President Bush. And Congress, or at least the Senate, wants it. And the thrust of the New York Times story is that this is being withheld. They will not give it to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And it's all blah, 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 blah. Why? Executive privilege, blah, blah, blah. But then we get to what I consider the lead, buried way back on page A13. This is from John McLaughlin, not the quickly now John McLaughlin, but the acting director of the CIA, who went on television this weekend. Man, is he campaigning for his job. He said the CIA should have included more caveats in the intelligence estimate. More caveats now, you see. And particularly in a section that summarized the key judgments, particularly in the summary. But on Tuesday, a senior intelligence official said of the presidential summary, and this is the lead that I think they buried, quote, "We expect people to read beyond one page," unquote. What do you think he's talking about? We expect people to read more than one page. Here's what I expect. Now, we're being told that when the Spanish electorate, in the wake of the Madrid terrorism, changed governments, even though the incumbent government had lied about who the apparent culprits were in the Madrid terrorism, the government was saying it was Al-Qaeda, the Basque separatists, it was actually apparently Al-Qaeda. Do I have that right? Anyway, the line here from the administration was, they have helped the terrorists. You see, when you change policies in response to terrorism attacks, you're helping, you're rewarding the terrorists. On the other hand, the Saudis are now widely reported to have cracked down on some terrorism. And that change in policy has been explained because it's happened in the wake of some terrorism attacks in Saudi Arabia. So there's a change in policy in the wake of terrorism that supposedly doesn't help the terrorists. Now, those are kind of clear cut. But I think what we need at this point, ladies and gentlemen, for example, I'd like to know if, God forbid, there's a terrorist attack. And shortly thereafter, the FCC loosens the rules for media ownership again. I'm not clear whether that helps or hurts the terrorists. Can we get just a whole list of what policies that would follow a terrorist attack would help them and what would hurt them? I think that would help us all. Helping us all. Hello, welcome to the show.
When they burn it down. pleases. And when the chopping is through, every piece will say, I love you.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to Le Show, so-called, because it is, in fact, a show. The banana reports flooded in this week. You know, do you know, that after a shocking incident at Atlanta Hartsfield International Airport, I put out the call on this broadcast for reports of an even more expensive banana than the one I encountered there. I think, what was the price? Now I forget, but I think it was like $1.50 for a banana, for one banana, ladies and gentlemen. Think of what the tree would cost. This week, reports flooded in. Of course, no, not of course, but albeit most of them were the same report. But first of all, a personal report from Jen in Redondo Beach. A few weeks ago, while traveling from L.A. International Airport to Hartford, Connecticut, I inquired about the price of a banana at a food-type vendor. Not a food vendor. A food-type vendor. Maybe they sold potted meat food product. I don't know. A food-type vendor in Terminal 6. The gentleman behind the counter told me they were $1.50. Well, that would be pretty much maybe that's the airport standard banana price. Maybe the airports have all, dare I use the word conspired, to set the price of bananas at $1.50. Jen concludes, I had a $6 bottle of beer instead. Well, you're down in the potassium account as a result. But now, this is the report that went around the world and came back to me a million times. Dateline London, reported by Agence France-Presse. Yeah, the French reporting from London. Imagine that. A banana half eaten by a British television presenter has been sold for $3,000 in an internet auction. Kate Garraway, not Dave Garraway, Kate Garraway, a presenter for the British breakfast television show GMTV. Isn't that wild? It was a Dave Garraway here who was on a morning show, and now there's a Kate Garraway in England on a morning show. Isn't that, that's almost as wild as the two intelligence agents. Anyway, Kate thought of the quirky idea during a television discussion about eccentric objects sold on eBay. Some 30,000 people reportedly made bids to buy the banana, between July 4th and 11th. Jamie Falarzik, who bought the item, said he will put the banana, or whatever's left of it, on display in front of his office to generate a bit more fun. Falarzik, who works for a online brokerage company, well, they have so much fun as it is, they just need a bit more. Said the money he paid is going to charity. Okay. People who think there's an award for finding the world's most expensive banana flooded me with these. So Jeff, Greg, Charles, Dan, Scott, it's a different Scott, Joe, Aileen Kiernan, and Iris all tied for reporting that. But that's really that's a stunt banana. You know what I'm saying? That's not a comestible. I'm talking about your good old, you need some fruit sugar, you need some fructose, you need some potassium, you just want a banana. You're not looking to give your online brokerage office a bit more fun. So those are the bananas I'm looking for. But good work, everybody. And good work, Kate, getting $30,000 for charity for eating the banana. So to speak. No, literally. Now, about Iraqi intelligence. About Iraq. Heard of it? There are reports this weekend that a bunch of the 9/11 hijackers were in Iran shortly before the fateful day. Isn't that wild? Tony Blair did not know a key piece of Iraqi intelligence had been discredited when he gave evidence to an inquiry last year on the subject. British intelligence agency MI6's decision to withdraw the intelligence was made before Blair testified. The first he heard of it was this week as a result of another inquiry. The intelligence report on alleged Iraqi production of chemical and biological weapons was received in mid-September 2002. The source had a major effect on the certainty of statements in the government's dossier of September 2002 that Iraq possessed and was producing chemical and biological weapons. But this report was subsequently withdrawn, according to this week's Butler report. Both reports, both of these intelligence reports, were withdrawn by British intelligence on July 17th last year. Although Tony Blair was not informed. What? What does that mean? Well, more clues. These are all clues now. We're connecting it's up to us to connect the dots, you see? Tony Blair, who this week said the Butler Report, which is this new report on pre-war intelligence, cleared him, secured vital changes in the report before its publication, watering down its explicit criticism of Tony Blair and the way he made the case for war in Parliament. This is according to the conservative pro-war British newspaper, The Telegraph. It's established that the original passage drew a much clearer contrast than the final version between the strong case for war made by Blair and the weakness of the intelligence that he received about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Just clues. Just dots. John Scarlett, who is the incoming head of the British intelligence, withheld crucial evidence that the intelligence had been discredited. So they're blaming him for not telling Tony Blair. But what about this country? Hey, got some dots here too. Almost beyond the bubble, almost outside the bubble, but not quite. This is from Knight Ridder newspapers. A former CIA director, this is James Woolsey, who the Los Angeles Times reports has been in the business of profiting from Iraq war, from contracts in post-war Iraq, pardon me. But he advocated war against Hussein before the war. He did something else, too. He helped arrange the debriefing of an Iraqi defector who falsely claimed that Iraq had biological warfare laboratories disguised as yogurt and milk trucks. You can't resist that intelligence. It's got some funny words in it, yogurt and milk trucks. On February 11th, 2002, Woolsey telephoned a deputy assistant defense secretary about the defector and told him how to contact the man, who had been produced by an Iraqi exile group eager to oust Saddam. This was passed on to the Defense Intelligence Agency. There's no indication that Woolsey was aware that Major Mohammed Harith had information that was unreliable. On the other hand, there's no indication that he didn't know. We don't know. The coalition of the wilting, ladies and gentlemen, the Bush administration faces growing challenges in holding together the coalition. Four countries already gone, another four due to leave by September, others now making known their intention to wind down or depart before the political transition is complete. The Philippines have pulled out by now. Norway quietly pulled out its 155 military engineers this month, leaving behind 15 Norwegians to help train. New Zealand intends to pull out its 60 engineers by September. Thailand plans to withdraw more than 450 troops that same month. The Netherlands will be pulling out next spring. Polish officials will take their large contingent out mid-next year. We think withdrawal sends the wrong signal, says the State Department. To track commitments, the Bush administration keeps, yes, a color-coded chart of coalition members. Red for countries withdrawing, how'd they choose that? Yellow for nations considering a pullout, and green for countries staying. They like these colors. Say what you will about this administration, it's colorful. Several participating countries in the coalition sent fewer than 100 troops. Thank you. Thank you so much. Moldova, which originally sent 42, is down to 12. Singapore, down from 191 to 33. The coalition of the tokens. No, they're still singing. There are countries that are increasing, just to be fair. South Korea is going up from 600 to 3,700. Azerbaijan is adding 250 to their 150. Georgia is doubling its 159 to more than 400. Hey, they green. They green. Italy is still split as to whether to keep its troops there. Okay. The coalition, ladies and gentlemen, of the whatever. And now, I hear you saying, you're almost halfway through the show. Where, Harry, are the copyrighted features? Ladies and gentlemen, they're right here. I hear copyright attorneys saying that. Even though, when I say copyrighted, it's like so much that people say these days. Tales of Airport Security, in case you didn't know. Dear Harry, this is from Robert in Elizaville, New York, among other places. 3 weeks ago on a flight from Hartford, man, Hartford, Connecticut figures prominently in today's broadcast. It's a theme show. 3 weeks ago on a flight from Hartford, Connecticut to San Juan, Puerto Rico, I put two packs of wooden matches in my checked suitcase because I was afraid to carry them on my person after the shoe bomber incident. When I got to Puerto Rico, the matches had been removed, and I found the following note from the Transportation Security Administration. Quote, TSA screeners have removed any plastic lighters or safety matches discovered in your luggage. For the safety of you and other passengers, the Department of Transportation Hazardous Materials Regulations prohibit the carriage of lighters or matches in checked baggage. You may carry a limited quantity of safety matches or butane lighters on an aircraft, either on your person or in your carry-on baggage. We appreciate your understanding and cooperation. What? Okay. Dear Harry, last week you recounted two Leatherman stories, and I contributed one to you about 2 years ago. I think we're seeing a pattern. For the sake of those who don't know what they are, Leatherman tools are the American version of the Swiss Army knife. Their distinguishing features are all steel construction, needle-nose pliers, and until recently they did not come with a corkscrew. I took my Leatherman with me on a driving trip where I mixed vacation with business and left it packed in my laptop bag on the return and forgot about it. On a recent trip from Cincinnati to Boston, I arrived at my hotel and discovered it in the outer PDA pocket of the laptop bag. I assume it should have stood out like a sore thumb on the X-ray machine, or more accurately, like a half-pound hunk of stainless steel. Wondering how I'd keep it during my upcoming flight to Newark the next day and back to Cincy the day after, I decided to just pack it in with my CD-ROM drive carrier in my briefcase and hope for camouflage, as I did by sandwiching it between my BlackBerry and cell phone in my jacket pocket 2 years ago. Worked like a charm. I made it through Logan security with no problems. On the way back, I decided not to press the point, put it in my suitcase and checked it. Mission accomplished without getting my property confiscated and put up on eBay, which has happened before. tales of airport security, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. More about Iraq. Just a little bit more. Again, from outside the bubble, is from the Sydney Morning Herald. Ayad Alawi. Now, we've discussed on this broadcast, and by we, I mean me, that Alawi had a history, reported in the New York Times earlier this year, of being part of a group that set off car bombs to destabilize Saddam Hussein's regime. But those are, I think we all understand this, those are good car bombs. Anyway, now comes the Sydney Morning Herald. Ayad Alawi, the new prime minister of Iraq, who, by the way, we are hailing as a tough guy, which is what's needed to solve the security situation over there. Ayad Alawi pulled a pistol and executed as many as six suspected insurgents at a Baghdad police station just days before control was handed over to him. Two people who say they witnessed the killing say the prisoners were handcuffed and blindfolded, lined up against a wall in a courtyard adjacent to the maximum security cell block in which they were held at the Al Amariya Security Center. They say Dr. Alawi told onlookers the victims had each killed as many as 50 and they deserved worse than death. The prime minister's office has denied the entirety of the witness accounts, saying Dr. Alawi never visited the center and he did not carry a gun. The informants told the newspaper Dr. Alawi shot each young man in the head as a dozen Iraqi policemen and four Americans from the prime minister's personal security team watched in stunned silence. Iraq's interior minister is said to have looked on and congratulated him when the job was done. His office has issued a verbal denial. One of the witnesses said Dr. Alawi had told those around him he wanted to send a clear message to the police on how to deal with insurgents. The interior minister said he would like to kill them all on the spot. Alawi said they deserved worse than death. Then he pulled the pistol and started shooting them. Each was shot in the head. I said Vincent Canestraro, a former CIA officer to the New Yorker, if you're asking me if Alawi has blood on his hands from his days in London, the answer is yes, he does. He was a paid intelligence agent for the Saddam regime, and he was involved in dirty stuff. Alawi's statement now dismisses the allegations as rumors instigated by enemies of his new government. But the witnesses who spoke to the newspaper, given the hunger for security in Iraq these days, did not perceive themselves as whistleblowers. In interviews with the newspaper, they were enthusiastic about such killings. The witnesses said Iraqi police observers were shocked and surprised, but asked what messages they might take from such an act. One said, "This is the new Iraq." He's a tough guy. And finally, from Stars and Stripes, the official newspaper. I don't know if it's official, but they sell to the soldiers. General Jack Keane. Quote, "When I look back on it myself, having participated and contributed to the war planning, one of the things that happened to us is that many of us got seduced by the Iraqi exiles in terms of what the outcome would be after the war. Therefore, the intellectual capital to prepare ourselves properly for an insurgency was not there. There were very few people who actually envisioned, honestly, before the war, what we are dealing with now after the regime went down," Keane said. "We did not see the insurgency coming. We were not properly prepared to deal with it." Here's how General Keane described the amount of intellectual capital poured into the post-war planning process. "If this represents the intellectual effort spent on planning the war," and he held his hands apart about a foot, "then this represents the intellectual effort behind the post-war planning." And he pinched his fingers together. Unquote.
Now
This is Le Show. Still to come, the apologies of the week. But first, ladies and gentlemen, the Greeks contracted for a Cadillac but are getting a Chevrolet, said an American security expert involved in the computerized security system the Greek government thought they had bought for the Olympic Games. Hey, you know, you knocking Chevys now? Cadillac is just a Chevy with a, what, bigger tires? Anyway, might make one glad what isn't going to the Olympics, but one, that is to say the host of this broadcast, is going to Boston to do some radio for the at the against, at around the Democratic Convention next week. As you know, there was a kerfuffle this week when the speakers were announced. It's just about, you know, people making speeches now and showing films. It's just a bad TV show. I don't know why I'm going, tell you the truth. I do, but I can't tell you in the air. Anyway, speakers were announced, and there was a kerfuffle when one of the names left off the speakers list. Now, Bill Clinton is, of course, on it, but Hillary Clinton was left off. She was going to be part of a group of 9 female senators. I think they were all senators. Anyway, 9 women, 9 prominent Democratic women. And she was going to be a silent member of that group. The spokesperson was going to be the senior one, Senator Barbara Mikulski. Let me just say this about Senator Barbara Mikulski. She has an onomatopoeic name. If you've never seen Barbara Mikulski, just give yourself a freedom to create a mental image when you hear the name Barbara Mikulski, and you've got it. So after some to-ing and fro-ing this week, Senator John Kerry announced that, in fact, Hillary Clinton would be a speaker at the Democratic National Convention. She will be introducing her husband at the convention. It sounds, you know, it does sound like another episode of Clinton Something. Coming up next here on the show.
Clinton Something, the Harlem Years.
Yeah, tell him I'm not going to meet the press with Mary again. I want a solo slot.
Hello, James. James Carville?
Yeah, this is my private...
James, this is John Kerry. I hope I'm interrupting something.
Don't you mean you hope you're not interrupting something?
I think the times are a little too serious for not interrupting something, James.
Mm.
Myself, I'm in the middle of writing my acceptance speech.
Yeah, I read. Legal pad and some pens, mm-hmm. Cut and paste with real paste. Makes you sound almost Amish.
James, it was good enough for Lincoln and it was good enough for Reagan.
Yeah, well...
Look, I know you keep in fairly good contact with Senator Clinton.
Fairly good? Man, we're closer than Siamese twins in a New York elevator at rush hour.
That is close.
We're closer than Cajun cousins.
Okay, I get it.
We're closer than...
James, I'd like to convey a message for you to pass on to Senator Clinton, if you'd be so kind.
Well, Mr. Senator, I'd like to, but we talk so seldom.
But I thought you...
I was flip-flopping. You know, the Republicans keep accusing us of it. It's time we started doing it. What's the message?
You'll have to pardon me, James. Not a lot of irony on the campaign plane. It tends to be counterproductive.
No, I know what you mean, sir. You know, when I ran John Chrétien's last campaign up in Canada, they printed up a T-shirt for me that said, "Think globally, speak literally." What's the message?
Well, James, you know that there's been a lot of flack about Hillary Clinton not being asked to speak at my convention.
Yeah, I heard about that flack.
Mm-hmm.
Tell you the truth, I think I started half of it.
Well, you know my consideration. She's not from the host state or the host city. She's not a former president or a former presidential candidate. And
she gets half the 2,000 people still watching the convention so ticked that they can spit sideways. I know, but
we've heard from a lot of folks in the female community.
That's a big community.
Oh, the biggest.
Mm.
And you know she's an historic figure, the former first lady to be elected to the Senate. Yeah,
Senator, I'm flattered. Hmm? You're quoting my own robo email back to me.
Come on, James. Don't make this any harder than it already is.
Yeah.
I want you to ask Senator Clinton if she'd agree to introduce her husband.
Oh, look, man. I think he can meet chicks on his own. He doesn't need an intro.
I mean at the convention.
Mm.
Before he speaks to the convention.
Hmm. Whose idea is that? Mary Beth's?
I think she was part of the process.
Man, that's some slick chief of staffing. Senator, I think that's the best idea I've heard since fried cheesecake. You bet I'll pass it on to the senator. And throw in a little lanyap, I'll tell her my advice is to accept.
But James, I appreciate it. I don't want to make any rash promises in return, let me assure you that when I become president, you can go on Meet the Press solo whenever you want.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate that. But Senator, what's hard about doing this? I mean, you're a fellow senator. You could call a...
James, this is profoundly embarrassing. Unlike all those stupid votes on amendments the Republicans keep dredging up for their commercials...
Yes, sir?
I really am flip-flopping. Let me know what she says.
You got it, Senator.
Here's your grande macchiato.
Thanks.
And me, I'm being a good boy. A triple non-fat cap. Here's to you, Toots.
Skull.
So.
You know, I have to admit, this strikes me as a little strange. A Starbucks in Harlem.
I know. It opened up about a month after I got here. If I was still into guilt, I'd feel a little guilty. It replaced a Mo' Fatty Fat Burger.
Well, nobody ever said gentrification was pretty. How's the book doing?
Your book?
You're a smart ass.
Oh, yeah. I think they've recouped their advance. I think they did that week two.
Well, that's good. Hate to poison the well for the presidential memoirs of the future.
That's right. One of them might need a big advance to pay off his legal bills, too.
Mm-hmm. Another president might be the victim of a vast right-wing zipper conspiracy.
Now, hey, hon.
Just kidding. Like we learned to do in counseling?
I know, but we're not in counseling now. We're in Starbucks. Anyway.
Well, I just wanted to know what you wanted me to say in my introduction. I mean, I suppose I could have just written it from memory, but...
No, I appreciate your asking. You know, it's not easy off the top of my head to think of something about me that isn't already in my speech, but...
How about this? They say hitch your wagon to a star. Well, here's a man that star hitched his wagon to.
It's cute, but it's kind of downbeat. I'm trying to stay away from the Ken Star stuff.
Really? Starting when?
You know, for the duration of the speech. Mm. Hey, how about something making fun of that speech I gave at the 88 convention?
I could say the first time Bill wasn't a nominee and addressed a Democratic convention, it was 1988. The speech went on until early 1989. And I began to think that the next high point in my life was going to be getting the gold watch from the Rose Law Firm.
That's good. That's very good. But, Rose Law Firm?
Yeah.
Kind of downbeat. A little bit of a buzzkill.
Okay. Maybe something like... He started out as the youngest governor of Arkansas. He's currently one of the youngest ex-presidents ever. And he's well on his way to being our youngest elder statesman.
Hmm. That's not bad.
That's Carville.
Yeah, it's got his rhythm. Still, I don't know.
What's wrong?
Elder. Sounds a little downbeat. Or churchy.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Look, hon, time's wasting and my cap's losing its foam. Why don't we just get you together with the team that's writing my speech? They'll just carve out a chunk of it for you.
I guess that'll work.
Mm-hmm. One thing does bother me, though, thinking about it.
What?
Well, that's the whole point of gentrification, is to be pretty, isn't it?
I guess you're right.
That's what I like to hear.
Youthful angst and middle-aged powerlessness. Together, they add up to Clinton something, the Harlem years.
When he's flat. wakes me up. He brings me back down again. Flash in the pan. Mood swinging man can pretend.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
The San Diego office of Metro Networks, a national company that provides news, traffic, and weather information to radio stations, is investigating complaints made by listeners of KFSD AM that a female Metro Networks reporter uttered profanities on the air July 5th between 5 and 6 p.m. The station is a classical music format. In any case, said the manager, he's been unable to verify if any profanities was said. The station does not keep a tape. In any case, if it did happen, we certainly do not approve of it, and we apologize to anyone who heard it or didn't hear it, if it didn't happen. A leading footwear company of London, which displayed the sacred Om symbol on its sandals, has apologized to Hindus and withdrawn the sale of the product after the community members protested against the insensitive depiction. I take this opportunity to apologize on behalf of Lacey's Footwear for any offense or hurt the design on the sandal has caused to any member of the Hindu community, Michael Ridgway of Lacey's said in a statement in London. We were completely unaware that the design could be read as a mirror image of the symbol Om. However, we're acting immediately to withdraw the shoe from sale forthwith. Secretary General of the Hindu Forum of Britain said the symbol represents a manifestation of God, and it's considered deeply offensive for people to step on it with their foot.
Sorry, sorry, sorry.
The New Orleans airport, where about 4% of the workforce in the airport screening contingent were arrested on charges of stealing stuff from passengers. For that, says Michael Robinson, U.S. Transportation Safety and Security Administration Director at New Orleans Louis Armstrong Airport, for that, we apologize. Martha Stewart says she's very, very sorry that it's come to this. She spoke after she was sentenced to 5 months in prison. By the way, Fox News is kind of hard on Martha. Kind of making fun of her. Kind of forgetting that one of their major commentators was convicted of lying to Congress, which he later minimized after he was released on the technical. Oliver North, of course. Thank you. U.S. officials are detaining terror suspects at undisclosed locations around the world, avoiding access to the International Committee of the Red Cross, says a spokesman for the Geneva-based aid organization. The Red Cross hasn't had access to a certain number of detainees listed as arrested on the website of the FBI or in media reports. U.S. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld last month said he agreed to a CIA request to take control of a suspected Iraqi terrorist and not list him as a prisoner. That violated Geneva Accords on treatment. The U.S. has apologized in this case, and the detainee is now registered with us, says the Red Cross. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage apologized this week to a senior Indian politician who was twice searched vigorously by airport security on visits to the United States. I called my friend not to express my regrets, but my sincere apologies, Armitage said. George Fernandez was India's defense minister in the recent government. But let's get the facts straight, says Armitage. He was not strip church. He removed his shoes, and I found this something worthy of an apology. As long as the shoes didn't have an ohm in them. Dateline Tallahassee, Florida, Department of Children and Family Secretary Jerry Regier apologized for actions he said appeared improper, including staying at the home of a contractor doing business with his agencies. And an investigation into a high number of prospective teachers failing exams required for certification in Louisiana found that overzealous grading resulted in 486 Louisiana applicants being told they flunked the test when they actually passed. Leave no teacher behind. Tom Ewing, spokesman for Education Testing Service that assembled the Praxis exam. Praxis doesn't make perfect, apparently, and arranges it for to be administered in 18 states, said his company has contacted each of the teachers, apologized, and is refunding the money they paid for testing. A whole lot of people passed, and a whole lot of people didn't, he said. But when complaints poured in about the number of failures, the company started checking all the tests that were on the cusp. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, Dateline London, Willie Schludecker, a German Second World War pilot, has apologized to a village for mistakenly bombing its church. Schludecker, 82, had dropped 4 half-ton bombs while trying to escape enemy fire during a raid May 1, 1942. I did not see the church and was aiming for a railway line. I realize now what I did and have come back to say sorry. It was a mistake, Schludecker was quoted as saying. One of the bombs went through the wall of the 1,000-year-old St. Andrew's Church in Northumberland, rolled down the aisle to the altar, and sat undiscovered for 24 hours. The hole it left has been turned into a memorial window. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. It's so copyrighted, it hurts. More apology. At this week's press tour for the television networks here in Southern California, Garth Ansier of the WB network said the network is now broadening its appeal beyond the 12 to 34 demographic that it sells to advertisers. Well, some of us didn't feel all that welcome before, said one television critic. I'm sorry, Ansier responded. I really am sorry about that. He's a good apologizer. I speak from personal experience. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week from Bosstown at the same time over these same stations, over not including one in Bosstown, by the way. Over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, and now available as a free download at audible.com/leshow. And it would be just like all of us leaving out the caveats if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. Not the dick caveats, the other ones. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. The show internet services by Steve Mack. A tip of the show chapeau to the Pittsburgh and San Diego desks for assistance in today's broadcast. The show playlists incessantly available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.